This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Earthwise, Environment and Peace with Justice interviews on Plains FM 96.9.
Welcome to Earthwise. I'm Lois Griffiths. Today's interview is very timely. Martin and I will be talking with Palestinian-American Ali Abu Nima, journalist, author, co-founder and director of the excellent website electronicintifada.net.
Well, Lois and I have been trying to follow the disturbing events taking place in Gaza, the violence directed against the Gazans as they gather facing the imprisonment barrier that has kept them enclosed, locked in for decades.
But we're not only disturbed by the violence, but also, frankly, very disturbed by the way events are reported or not reported, the silence by our New Zealand print and radio media. So welcome to Earthwise journalist Ali Abu Nima.
Thank you very much.
Well, Ali, you're following events closely, I'm sure, and you've contacts. What do you see as the purpose of what's being called the Great March of Return?
The purpose is simply, as Palestinians in Gaza are telling us, to wake the world up from its silence about the fact that 2 million Palestinians have been locked in the Gaza Strip, an open-air prison, as the former British Prime Minister David Cameron once called it, and under sharply deteriorating conditions, a collapsed economy because of the Israeli siege, a collapsed healthcare system in which people are dying for lack of treatment in Gaza because the healthcare system is in such collapse, and really a disastrous situation. And why is the march happening now? Well, because this is the 70th anniversary of the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, and more than two-thirds of the Palestinians in Gaza are themselves refugees or the direct descendants of refugees who are expelled from lands that are now in Israel. And it's important to note that these lands are largely empty. Their lands to the east of Gaza and to the north of Gaza, areas which are still largely empty since Palestinians were ethnically cleansed. But Israel doesn't allow Palestinians to return to their homes and to their land because they're not Jewish. Israel, of course, defines itself as a Jewish state. So these Great March of Return rallies were launched on March 30th, two Fridays ago. March 30th is Land Day, and that commemorates what happened on that day in 1976, when Palestinians in the north of Palestine and the Galilee went out to protest the confiscation of land by Israel, and Israel met them with lethal force, unarmed protesters, and six people were killed on that day in 1976. And since then, Palestinians have commemorated it as Land Day. And they're planned to continue every Friday until the 15th of May, which is Nakba Day, which commemorates the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. And what happened on March 30th, 2018, in Gaza is precisely what happened on March 30th, 1976, in the Galilee, which is Israel met unarmed protesters with a lethal force, with light fire. The result was a horrific massacre. On that day, 14 Palestinians were shot dead, and more than 500 were injured with live ammunition. And the following Friday, the same thing happened. Up to this point, some 30 Palestinians have been killed by live fire. In an unprecedented move on this past Sunday, the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court actually issued a public warning to Israeli leaders that they could face war crimes trials over this. But the biggest story, as you alluded in the introduction, has been the international silence and really a shrug from the so-called international community as Israel continues to shoot and threaten to shoot unarmed Palestinians simply for protesting for their rights.
How do you contribute to silence? I mean, does that even apply to the very well-known publications like the New York Times?
Maybe especially
well,
to
the New York Times. The New York Times is not silent. I think there's two main things one sees in the media coverage. One is silence, which means, you know, very little coverage or cursory coverage. And the other is distortion. And what that means is where there is coverage, that it is done through a lens that very much suits the Israeli army and the Israeli government's propaganda narrative. And that's where I'd situate the New York Times, which, typical of many other publications, falsely presents this as clashes. That's the word they often use. And they often use very passive language. So they'll say, 14 Palestinians die in clashes. So, you know, when you say Palestinians die, you don't say who's killing them. And this is presented as if it was sort of a two-sided battle or two-sided conflict, ignoring the fact that not a single Israeli has been injured, and more than 2,000 Palestinians have been injured, a large number of them with live ammunition being fired at their heads, at their chests, and at their extremities in ways that seem calculated to disable them. And among those killed up to this point are three children, one aged 13, one aged 15, and one aged 17, and the journalist Yasser Murtaza, who was shot while wearing a clearly marked bulletproof vest marked with the word press. And, you know, we've had all these sorts of lies from the Israelis. The defense minister claimed that he had been operating a drone. Of course, had he been operating a camera drone, that wouldn't have justified summarily executing him. But that was a lie. No, you know, the Israeli army itself said there was no evidence whatsoever of anyone operating a drone. And the other thing that the defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, has said, which really goes to the mindset of the Israeli leaders, is, and he said this was quoted directly, there are no innocent Palestinians in Gaza. There are no innocent civilians. That was his exact word, that there are no innocent civilians in Gaza.
In fact, they just think of all Palestinians, I mean, from the cradle upwards, as terrorists, and that's the language they use about all Palestinians, isn't it?
They do, and it's I think the only difference now between what Israel is doing now and what it did back in 1976 or back in 1956 with the Kfar Qasim massacre, or back in 1948, or name any period in the past 70 years, the only difference is not the way Israel is acting. Israel has always killed Palestinians, injured Palestinians in huge numbers. The only difference now is the sheer shamelessness. In the past, there was an effort by Israel to deny its actions or to sugarcoat them or to explain them away. Now Israel just does it openly because it is so assured of impunity from the so-called international community. Israel fears no consequences. That's why it acts in the way it does. And that's why I think the statement from the ICC prosecutor was so significant, because even the International Criminal Court has dragged its feet when it comes to Israel. There are cases before the court, before the prosecutor's office, where she's been, you know, dragging it on for years about whether to open a formal investigation. And it looked like, at least up until Sunday, that she was not going to take any action at all. And so for her to come out with this statement, this warning, I think should give us some hope that, you know, maybe that will be one avenue where Israel's impunity will be challenged, but I'll believe it when I see it.
Yes, I mean, with our experience of what's happened, the total impunity, you're very right to believe it when you see it.
The role of the UN is disturbing, isn't it? Actually, New Zealand supposedly is a strong supporter of the UN. And back to the case of refugees, there was, as long ago as 1948, there was a resolution that said the refugees could return, wasn't there?
Yes, and that resolution, number 194, has been reaffirmed every year by the UN General Assembly. And let's be clear that the issue of refugees returning home is not controversial in any other context. Take, for example, now, nobody would dispute, I've heard no one dispute, that Syrian refugees have the right to go home, whether they're in Germany or Turkey or Jordan or Lebanon. They have the right to go home as soon as it is safe for them to do so, and provided they're doing so voluntarily. That's just an uncontroversial position. No one says that they shouldn't ever be allowed to return to Syria. Same with Rohingya people being expelled by the brutal regime of Aung San Suu Kyi in Myanmar. You know, the actual demand of the international community is that Myanmar allow Rohingya who have been expelled or fled to Bangladesh to return home. And this has always been true in every other conflict situation. It is only Israel that is treated as a special case where it is presumed that Israel may deny these fundamental rights to Palestinians solely on ethnic or racial grounds, that Palestinians are the wrong ethnicity or the wrong religion. So this is the thing to understand, is that Palestinians, millions of them, are being kept in the ghetto in Gaza or being kept in forced exile outside Palestine for one reason and one reason alone, which is that they're not Jewish, and that is an ethno-racial criteria imposed by Israel, which has no basis and no legitimacy whatsoever in international law.
And yet, if you use the word apartheid from outside, they really take offense and say, how dare you say that?
I think it's become less controversial even within Israel because, you know, many Israelis say it. It's now, we had just over a year ago, a UN report that found beyond a reasonable doubt that Israel practices apartheid. A few weeks ago, I was in South Africa. I was invited to South Africa for Israeli Apartheid Week, and it was really wonderful to feel the energy of activists there, the strength of solidarity. But one of the things that was very striking, has been very striking in the past few months, is that the government of South Africa, for the first time, has come out and described Israel as an apartheid state. South Africa had never done that officially. There were many prominent figures in South Africa, including the likes of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who had likened Israel's behavior to apartheid. Many even said it was worse than apartheid that they experienced in South Africa. But it's only since December that the government of South Africa has officially called Israel an apartheid state.
You're listening to Earthwise, broadcasting in Christchurch on Plains FM 96.9. in Hamilton on Free FM, and in Waikanae on Coast Access FM. Today's guest is Palestinian-American Ali Abu Nima, journalist, author, co-founder and director of the website electronicintifada.net.
Well, Ali, I think one thing that we need to try and understand is why is the so difficult to get past the Israeli version of events? Not that long ago, you went to a conference talking about AIPAC. Could you explain to us what AIPAC is?
Yes, that was a conference in Washington on the Israel lobby and American policy, how the Israel lobby influences the United States. And, of course, that's a topic we could talk a lot about. But, you know, really, the Israel lobby is a real thing. I mean, it's very active, it's very influential, it's made up of a lot of different organizations and individuals. I mean, I always caution that we mustn't say that the lobby has total power. It doesn't. It doesn't get its way on everything, and particularly it's not able to suppress the growing popular and grassroots opinion around the world in support of Palestinian rights. But it certainly does have a very powerful effect on, I think what it comes down to is bullying and intimidating institutions and individuals into staying silent. So I think what you have now is not so much people all clamoring to speak out in support of Israel. It's that I think the lobby has successfully created an environment, particularly in the United States, where people just remain silent. And I'll give you an example. For the first few days of, after the massacre on the 30th of March this year, not one single member of the United States Congress, or let me put it this way, we could count, I think it was three, actually, it might have been four members of the United States Congress. That's four out of 535 who had criticized Israel's actions in Gaza. A very tiny number who had, less than 1% were willing to speak out to criticize Israel. But here was something even more surprising to me. The number who actually spoke out in support of Israel was even less. It was zero. And to me, that's a very significant change. I mean, in a way, it's a kind of progress. What it tells you is that the lobby has managed to intimidate people into silence. But what they're not able to do is to force them to speak out in Israel's support. And I think it was very significant that, not one Democrat, not one Republican came out in support of what Israel did. I think eventually Ted Cruz, the senator from Texas, did. But that, in a way, really just underlined how Israel's support has really become very concentrated at the extremes, because Ted Cruz is seen as a very, very far-right kind of individual.
And in the meantime, these demonstrations, the Great March of Return, are going to continue. You mentioned at the beginning, you used the phrase prison. I think it's stronger than that, isn't it? It's more like a concentration camp, isn't it? It's a place where people can't live.
I think that is accurate. And it's particularly accurate when you understand that the concentration camps were invented by the British in southern Africa, and used against the Boers, the French and Dutch settlers who had arrived. And the idea is you take a population and you force them into a tiny area in which they're not free to enter or leave, and which they're subjected to conditions that make sustainable life impossible or very difficult. And that's exactly the situation in Gaza. I mean, take this statistic. We're talking about, and the world is talking about, rightly, or at least many people are, the 30 who have been brutally killed by the Israeli army in the past 2 weeks. But in 2017, 54 Palestinians died in Gaza because they were sick. They had treatable illnesses, sometimes cancer. Many of them were cancer patients. But they couldn't get treatment in Gaza because the siege has really caused the collapse of the healthcare system. So what they have to do is apply for permits from Israel to leave the Gaza ghetto to try to go to a hospital in the West Bank or in Jordan or sometimes even in Israel. And Israel denied them permits and they died waiting for treatment. That, to me, is a silent massacre. And those statistics come from the World Health Organization. And the World Health Organization also said that in 2017, the number of approvals that Israel gave for medical exit permits from Gaza hit the lowest level since records began. So this is what is never talked about, or very rarely talked about in the media, and it's why people in Gaza are prepared to march in these large numbers to go to the border, knowing that the Israeli snipers have orders to shoot them, because they're saying, we want a dignified life, we want our rights, we don't want to be ignored by the world, we don't want to just be warehoused as an unwanted population that is of no consequence. And that really is the fundamental message from these marches. And it's what people in Gaza are giving their life for.
What are the reactions within Israel? Is there any support on behalf of the Palestinians? Any sympathy at all?
I would say there is, but it's very marginal, at least from what we can tell from the mainstream media and from what politicians are saying. And across the board, you know, the leader of the supposedly center-left opposition Labour Party in Israel has come out fully in support of the government's shoot-to-kill policy against unarmed demonstrators. So there isn't a lot of difference along the political spectrum there. And I think Israel has become such a hyper-militarized and indoctrinated society where children are indoctrinated from a very young age that Israel is under threat, that we're surrounded by enemies. They start indoctrinating them when they're still in high school to go to the army. And when they're in the army, they're indoctrinated by very radicalized rabbis. The army's education system since the mid-1990s has become more extreme and more religious. And so there is very little dissent in Israel. And there have been demonstrations of a few hundred people here and there, which I don't want to discount. But there isn't a movement in Israel. There isn't a viable real opposition movement in Israel. And that's critical to understand, because the change is not going to come from within Israel. The change is only going to come if there is external pressure that forces Israeli society to reckon with this situation and to actually change course. And that's really the analogy, where the analogy to me with apartheid South Africa is so strong. And it was the point stressed again and again by people I talked to when I was in South Africa, that external pressure, international solidarity, were fundamental to forcing a change within South Africa.
Which is where BDS comes in, which is boycott, divestment, sanctions, as in South Africa.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. And that's when New Zealand comes in, of course, because New Zealand played such a key role in elevating the international sporting boycott of South Africa with the Springbok Tour, brought it to an international audience. And we want to see New Zealand play that role again. By the way, just this morning as we're speaking, the City Council in Dublin passed a historic resolution endorsing BDS, boycott, divestment and sanctions, and calling on the Irish government to expel the Israeli ambassador. And that was really a wonderful decision by the Dublin City Council. But it also reminds me of what happened in the 1980s, because remember back then, national governments were the most resistant. They did not want to impose sanctions on apartheid South Africa. It really started in local councils, in universities, in churches. And I think we're going to follow the same course. It's only when people everywhere, you know, in their communities, in their organizations, have expressed their opinion on this issue that governments start to listen and to act.
Well, Ali, I just have a quote from Gideon Levy, who said that hard-heartedness has befallen Israeli society so hard that it blocks humanity and compassion from reaching the heart. It's quite strong language, isn't it?
It is, but I think it's true. And sadly, I think it's always been true, because, in this period, we are thinking not just dealing with the present disaster facing Palestinians, but thinking back 70 years to the Nakba. April 9th was the 70th anniversary of Deir Yassin, which was the massacre in the small village near Jerusalem, which was such a key part in precipitating the expulsion and flight of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in 1948. And so Palestinians have never found mercy from Israel's heart. And I think other people in the world might be waking up to that now, but Palestinians have always seen the same face of Israel. And it's the same face that they're seeing across the boundary line in Gaza with Israeli snipers shooting at unarmed protesters.
Well, it's been always a pleasure to talk to you. Appreciate your giving the time, and I appreciate you provide real journalism, which I'm afraid we're not getting here. The reports we've had in our own newspaper had
the clashes
quite long covers, quite a large coverage, but quoting the Israeli general and nobody else.
Well, one thing I want to say I'm very proud of at the Electronic Intifada is we have very good reporters in Gaza. And they are writing from there. We had some of them on our podcast, so people can listen to that. It's all at the Electronic Intifada website. And one of the things I'm most proud of is getting their voices out to the world. So I hope people will take a look at that as well.
Yes, I do recommend that website, electronicintifada.net.
Well, thank you very much, Ali, and we'll talk to you next time.
So from us at Earthwise?
Thank you both.
So from us at Earthwise, goodbye.
Goodbye.